Okay, so hello everyone. So what I hopefully want to cover over the next three sessions, a little brief history about American Jewry and attempts within the Jewish community to unite and we think now perhaps like, is there ever a possibility of the Reform and Orthodox communities finding common ground on religious issues? It seems almost impossible. Well, you know, obviously different times these things were possible. Today we're going to speak about the attempt to unite all of American Jewry from all different types of religious streams. In the next session we'll talk about the attempted merger of YU and JTS and where conservative, at some point, conservative Judaism and Orthodox Judaism also seem perhaps somewhat similar. So let's begin. The background is going to be a little more extensive than normal. Some of us probably are familiar with this, but just to give a brief background before we do our topic about attempts at unity. So the American Jewish community begins around 1654. A small French boat named St. Catherine came with 23 Jews, four couples, two widows, 13 children. They land in New Amsterdam. Basically, they had run out of money. And they only had the furniture that they had with them that could not be sold. And they were refugees from the Inquisition. And they simply wanted permission to live amongst the local residents and conduct trade. Jews were allowed to stay. But for the most part, and again, I'm just going to give a brief, I'm going to run through this pretty quickly. Very few Jews come to colonial America because it was remote, it was dangerous. And most importantly, there was no Jewish community, right? There was no established, as we know, be a traditional Jew means to belong to a traditional Jewish community. So the Jews, probably the first Jews who moved to America, by and large, are those who are least bound by tradition. It's very difficult, as we know, to be a traditional Jew, to maintain Jewish life if you're living in America. In 1685, the approximately 20 Jewish families in New York, they petitioned for the right to worship publicly. They were refused. However, around the turn of the 18th century, public worship becomes available to Jews without any fanfare, just as other religions were also beginning to enjoy these benefits as well. Now, So the early synagogues, who's running them? There are no rabbis, okay? There are no rabbis in early America. The people who are running the synagogues are, who's in charge? The wealthy balabas, right? The wealthy lay leaders are in charge of the rules. But initially, there's no desire to reform the synagogues. Jews at this time would have viewed any kind of revolutionary ideas as dangerous to Judaism. We're talking about the 1700s. And no synagogues hired a chacham, a sage, prior to the revolution. And the rabbis generally did not come to American synagogues before like the 1840s, for the most part. Basically, you had a chazan, you had someone who was in charge of the liturgy, and he would also probably engage in many of the ceremonial roles that a chacham would perform. And the early synagogues were Sherit Yisrael in New York, Touro Synagogue in Newport, I'm sure we visited these places, Savannah, Charleston, Philadelphia, and the evidence seems to indicate from the books that talk about early American Jewry, there were maybe 1,000 to 2,500 Jews at the time of the revolution. And all Americans, including Jews, are granted freedom of religion based, and there is church-state separation. Now, one of the challenges that America has now of this new freedom is, do individuals have the right to challenge synagogue rules? I'll give you an example. In 1784, there is a native of Tells, Lithuania, moves to America. His name is Mordechai Moses Mordechai, MMM. He was one of the most learned members of the lay community. He was the lay member of Congregation Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. And he was accused of performing an unauthorized Jewish marriage ceremony on a previously intermarried couple. His niece, Mrs. Hart, and her unconverted Christian husband, Lieutenant James Pettigrew. So they married, basically, according to the, you know, not civilly, and he married them according to his Jewish view. And in 1785, he also performed the last rites of an identifying but intermarried Jew when the synagogue, the synagogue had the rule that if someone's intermarried, they can be buried, but you can't do any of these burial rites. He claimed that he knew more than the synagogue leaders, and the question is, what could community do about this? And basically, when you have freedom, so basically, there's no rabbi in America, first of all, to excommunicate anyone. In the Middle Ages, that was if the community didn't like what someone was doing, they would excommunicate them. This, as a last resort, this is against the spirit of American freedom to excommunicate other people. The spirit of freedom is I can do what I want. In 1826, Philadelphia Jews vote to admit a man into Mikveh Israel membership, even though he is a mamzer, because not doing so would undermine the spirit of liberty. Again, the London chief rabbis, who apparently they consulted, said it was usher, it was forbidden, but the community said we're allowing it because not to allow it is against the spirit of liberty. And you begin to see tensions between the liberal spirit of America and the traditional synagogue community. Originally, you had one shul, every community, yeah?
The big difference in America was the rally the previous 2,000 years. Anytime Jews moved someplace, they didn't do so willingly, they were forced out. So wherever they left, rabbis, everyone came together. So where they landed, the rabbis were able to reinstate, continue whatever they've been doing, whatever they've been before. Right. The United States was the first country where Jews were able to move to independently without seeking the king's permission. So but the rabbis mostly primarily stayed in Europe.
Yeah, there are no.
First time you had all these people coming, never had it before, lay people coming, so I don't know.
Right, right. The rabbis didn't come, like I said, until 1840, 100%. They didn't come. And, but I think it was also. Yeah, there's some. Yeah, we'll talk about it. Yeah. Originally you had sort of one synagogue, and this synagogue claimed authority for all Jewish life. Eventually, there were Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jewish synagogues, and there was a weakened authority of synagogue authority over life. I'll give you another example. In New York in 1813, the Shochet of Sheri Israel, Jacob Abrahams, so he decided to reject the congregation's terms of employment. He decides, I'm going to sell kosher meat independently, not with, like I have my own hashgacha. This was a challenge to the synagogue. The synagogue tried to get the New York Common Council to pass an ordinance that no butcher may sell meat as Jews' meat who shall not be engaged for that purpose by Sheri Yisrael. They can only sell it through the synagogue. However, his supporters claim, what? This infringes on his civil rights. The Common Council revoked its original ordinance and said it would not involve itself in this matter. So from now on, the synagogue community's authority over kosher meat was only voluntary. And on November 15th, 1825, B'nai Yeshurun was New York's first Ashkenazic congregation. Again, they originally had Sheri Yisrael. Now, 1825, now they have an Ashkenazic congregation. It's based on German and Polish customs. Until then, the only shul in New York City was, as I mentioned, Sheri Yisrael, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. In Charleston, young Jews formed a new synagogue in 1825 with changes in the traditional Jewish practice. An abbreviated service, prayers in English, the weekly sermon. It was called the Reformed Society of Israelites for Promoting the True Principles of Judaism According to Its Purity and Spirit. Well, it's a very long title. It was the first Reformed synagogue in America. And from now on, if you didn't like what the synagogue was doing, what would you do? You break away, you start your own shul. Now, there used to be one shul, one town, everyone belongs to the synagogue. But now, in America, freedom, if I don't like what's going on, I'm going to form my own synagogue. And by the Civil War, every major American Jewish community had at least two synagogues. And larger ones, there were four or more. Now, American
the one I go to and the one I don't go
Right, the one that it works out. Now, American synagogue Jews can now choose from a number of congregations and synagogues. Instead of saying, these are my rules and we're going to excommunicate you if you don't follow them, and you better, you know, follow my wishes, what happened? Now they have to compete for members. Now they see that there's a total shift now. And now instead of saying, okay, you don't follow my rules, you're going, now you have to, a number of congregations had to compete for members, and they had to satisfy existing members so that they won't attend, you know, neighboring synagogues, right?
Rabbi, was the situation different in Europe only culturally or legally as well?
Well, legally there were roles. There were official city rabbis, and we're going to talk about that. There were no like really city, there were communal rabbis, and some rabbis had authority that was endorsed by the state. Basically, they like, no more are we going to punish someone who doesn't do something right with fines or sanctioning people. Because why? If I'm sanctioned, I just go to the other shul, right? So what some refer to is that the synagogue community was replaced by a community of synagogues, right? A little shift there. And synagogues represented the diversity of Jewish life. Now, between 1820 and 1840, the Jewish population increased from 3,000 to 15,000. From 1840 to 1860, it increased to 150,000. And in 1877, the first official census of the American Jewish community, they say there are 250,000 Jews, American Jews. And Jews come from many diverse places. From the mid-1820s to 1870s, they're mostly coming from Germany, right? Bavaria, Western Prussia, Posen, right? And they're mostly young, unmarried, and poor. And they, the immigration to America by Jews is so much more percentage-wise than non-Jews, not in the totality, but the rate was much greater. Why? Because there are many more restrictions on Jews in Europe, where they could live, what kind of work they could pursue, and actually one community whom they can marry. There was a rule in Bavaria that only the eldest son can marry. Like, there are some really crazy rules. So there was a greater desire by Jews to emigrate from Germany to America than non-Jews. They also moved for economic opportunity and religious freedom. And there were failed revolutions in Europe in 1848, and so there was a lot of movement, but there was also a fear for the survival of Judaism in America. Why? Because a lot of Jews in America, now, there are a lot of Jews in America, and they have the freedom to practice religion and freedom not to practice religion. There's no obligatory membership, so now you need to, as I mentioned, synagogues need to attract members. If people don't like the practice of the current synagogue, they just start their own. And there were really three broad strategies to deal with this issue of how we're going to have Judaism surviving in this new country. So one suggestion, one strategy, is to strengthen Jewish education and make Jewish practice appealing to the American Jew. That's like the Frum approach. Second approach would be to reform Judaism, or focus, and that's the reform, you know, some of the traditions, to make it more appealing. There's actually a third approach also, which is to focus on community and kinship rather than rituals and faith. Sort of like the B'nai B'rith model. And as you know, you either have your traditional synagogues, just make it more appealing, or you have, we're going to reform the traditions, or we're going to have like the B'nai B'rith model. Forget about the synagogues, let's focus on things that that unite Jews. Now, Isaac Leeser, he's a picture on the left. So he was born in 1806. He died in 1868. He was the prominent Jewish traditional leader in America for over three decades. He was born in Prussia. He was orphaned at the age of 14. He received a Jewish and general education before he immigrates to the United States in 1824. He quickly learns English, and he becomes a scholar, a defender of Judaism, and he became a competent synagogue officiant. Again, he's not a rabbi, he's not your standard rabbi of learning in the traditional yeshivos, but he was hired in 1829 by Philadelphia's congregation Mikveh Yisrael to serve as the chazan. But that was the primary ritual role in the synagogue. His job was to read the prayers in Hebrew, and according to the custom of the Portuguese Jews, to attend all the funerals and the mourning service, to perform other life cycle rituals. Now, what's interesting is he was Ashkenazic, but he served in the Sephardic shul, sort of like Rabbi Meir Yaakov Soloveitchik. Okay, but the... What? Oh, so, okay, I'll show this. But within a year, he begins preaching English language sermons, which was somewhat radical, but not completely radical, right? Preaching in the vernacular. He preaches against sin. He promotes a return to traditional beliefs.
Was it Hebrew or Yiddish? What language was it prior to?
Okay, that's not Yiddish.
That's
prior.
So whatever the...
They didn't speak Yiddish.
They didn't speak Yiddish, right. So it's the English, right.
Before that.
Spanish too, they didn't speak Yiddish.
Right. They didn't speak, right. Spanish, Portuguese, but not. You're thinking about the German shuls, right? Think about the German shuls. So he preached Judaism, but he also advocated the Americanization of Judaism. He insisted that all sermons be delivered in English. He employed English in all of his own publications. He had many translation projects. He was against Cheirem. In his mind, publicly excommunicating someone ran against traditional American Jewish beliefs, American values. He called an American Jewish love to embrace beauty, elegance, and refinement. It seems, again, on a much lower scale, he sort of was like, he followed the approach of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was a tremendous scholar, and he a tremendous writer, philosopher. But in terms of like the overall hashkafa of like a modernized Judaism without compromising the basic values of Judaism, but trying to make it more appealing to modern Jews, it seems like he followed that model. And he called for more refinement in the area of davening, a system for distribution of alios. The original there was auctioning. And he says, no child under 5 years should be allowed in the main sanctuary, okay? No girl should be allowed in the men's section. Individuals should recite the prayers in a low tone of voice. No person shall interrupt or correct the chazan during the service of reading of the Torah. No one calling out. In other words, he was looking for a much more dignified, you know, there's a question, what will bring the masses in? So if you look in like the, you know, perhaps in the churches, all right, so there was more of like a dignified type of service, and Jews do like, you know, we do what we do, we're traditional, we're like very, it wasn't very formal, but it lacked the feeling of, you know, reverence and solemnity, and it wasn't attracted to many Jews, and therefore he felt like we need to make it, you know, more of the atmosphere should be something that would be more appealing, more refinement. But he believed, of course, that education is the key to Judaism's advancement. He advocates all day schools that combine Jewish and general studies in a Jewish religious setting. He said sending to public school is spiritually dangerous. Now, so that was sort of his model. However, other Jews, as I mentioned, felt that Judaism needed to reform in order to survive. So as I mentioned, you had that first Reform synagogue or Reform temple in Charleston in 1825. That synagogue sort of falls apart about 13 years later. In 1834, at She'erit Yisrael's new Crosby synagogue dedication, Mordechai Noah was probably one of the most influential Jews in the early 19th century. He surprised his audience by promoting limited reforms in Jewish law. For example, synagogue music and prayers in the vernacular. Now, the most significant early controversy surrounding a synagogue reform and the first to wind up in court revolved around the organ. The first known proposal to introduce an organ into an American synagogue, obviously on Shabbos, came in 1840 as the members of Charleston's Beit Elohim were completing a new building. The congregation's new minister, a native of Poland, it advocated this innovation, and the community voted 46-40 in favor of the organ. Now, many traditionalists left the synagogue because we can't have it, and they form a new congregation, Sheirit Yisrael. Then the reformers, what do? They change the congregation's constitution to exclude the traditionalists and to add more reforms, including vernacular prayers, prayers in the vernacular, revisions concerning, you know, mentioning the coming of the Mashiach in the Tefillah and the resurrection of the dead, and they got rid of second day, not Shabbos, no, not that far. They got rid of second day Yom Tov. The last innovation of getting rid of second day Yom Tov caused many moderate reformers to join. Caused many moderate reformers to join Sheri Israel and try to oust the leadership of Bet Elohim. And there was a battle in the courts for many years. The court held that no synagogue charter could establish the exact kind of music that was to be used in the future all time. But the court's ruling made it impossible to mount a successful legal challenge against a majority bent on reforming traditional Jewish practice. You couldn't say, this synagogue, you have to do X, or these are the rules. Whatever the majority wants. So basically, after this ruling, whatever majority wanted the synagogue, that's what went. Just give me one more second. This organ dispute clearly separated Reform Jews from their opponents. And in response to this, they started calling themselves a new name, Orthodox. Orthodox. This term of Orthodox begins to crop up around 1844. This became the term of choice for Jews who opposed reform in the 1840s. And according to the Orthodox rabbi in Charleston, it meant true adherence to our holy religion in its ancient form. Yeah, Howie.
Well, the movement of the second day was consistent with the reform philosophy of we're not a nation, we're a religion. So they called them, the synagogues were called temples. They said, we have no connection to the East. Our temples here, our synagogues are a temple, not some temple in Jerusalem. And therefore, so we're not an exile, or how they put this like it is in the Bible.
Like in the Bible.
Right.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. I mean, it could also simply be a rejection of. I think that's right. There's also a rejection of rabbinic Judaism in a sense. But yeah, meanwhile, so now you have Jewish German immigrants, and a lot of the Jewish German immigrants, come and they're very interested in reform. In New York, there's a small group of young German immigrants establish a full-scale congregation called, interesting name, Emmanuel. What does Emmanuel mean? God is with us, not with you, okay? All right, and not with us, the Reform, not with the Orthodox. That started in 1845. And they introduced German hymns, a sermon, an abbreviated service, and organ music. And again, this strategy remained highly controversial. The reason why, because In the beginning of the 1840s, you had the modern Orthodox. I don't know if they were called modern Orthodox then, but you had the Isaac Leiser. The Reform could not point to a single nationwide leader of the status to stand opposite Isaac Leiser in the beginning of the 1840s. And again, just want to point out that before the 1840s, I mentioned there were no rabbis anyway. There are no ordained rabbis in any of these pulpits. Even Isaac Leiser was treated as a common subordinate by the president of his congregation, so much so he eventually resigned from his position. The first ordained rabbi to settle in America was Rabbi Abraham Rice. Originally he was Reese. He arrived in 1840 from Bavaria. He seems to have immigrated to America at the age of 38 because of poverty, after the death of their only child, and a fervent commitment to establish pure Orthodox belief in the United States. Soon after, a group of ordained and not so ordained rabbis migrate to the United States. There were at least 11 in the 1840s. Four of them boasted the double credentials that would shortly become the hallmark of modern professional rabbis: a secular university degree and a rabbinical degree. And there were rabbis who stood at all ends of the spectrum. You had Rabbi Rice, who had an unwavering commitment to orthodoxy. He lacked modern education, but he was eloquent in his oratory. There was no job for him in New York, so he ends up in Baltimore, the Baltimore Hebrew congregation. And he represents tradition to the extreme, defender of the faith. And this is rarely emulated until different group of rabbis come about 40 years later. Like, the Charit, whatever, the more very religious. And he faced dissent from his congregants, and he resigns in 1849. Then you had this rabbi, like Rabbi Morris Rafal, born 1798, died 1868. He was an Orthodox rabbi. He had impressive university credentials. He had a doctorate from the University of Erlangen, and he had wonderful oratorical skills. He championed a modernized accommodationist orthodoxy that focused on preaching, education, and aesthetics, but no fundamental change to Judaism. He is born in Stockholm. He settles in England before migrating to the United States. He's got perfect English. He's a scholar. And he's offered tenure in 1849 by the New York's congregation, B'nai Yeshurun. He was known as the, quote, first, quote, glamour rabbi in American Jewish history, the highest salary of any American rabbi of his day, $2,000 a year. Okay? So, who was the Reform community going to turn to for spiritual leadership? And the rabbi was Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise. He's the middle picture here. Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise arrives in the United States of America in 1846 after having served as a teacher for 3 years in Bohemia. In 1850, he enters into a debate with Rabbi Morris Rafal, the glamour rabbi, about, and in this debate, Rabbi Rafal turns to Isaac Meir Wise and says, quote, "Do you believe in the personal Messiah? Do you believe in bodily resurrection?" "No," was the answer by the young preacher. And at that moment, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise distanced himself from Orthodox Jewish theology. Now, at the time of this debate, he was the rabbi in Albany. He introduced some ritual modifications. He organized a mixed choir. But when asked if he was a reformer, he explained he was only a reformer if the people long for it, but he never urges his principles on another. However, once he makes this statement in his debate and it goes viral on the non-existent internet in 1850, his real view comes to the fore. He's dismissed from his pulpit 2 days before Rosh Hashanah. He considers the firing to be illegal. The courts agreed that there was this altercation on Rosh Hashanah. He was given a kibbutz, but the president of the shul blocked him from taking the Torah. And the second day, he was in his home. Okay, it's pretty rough. He got it from me. I forgot. I don't know where, but he got traditional. Yeah, traditional. Yeah. So the supporters started a breakaway shul called Anshe MS. And it was a reformed congregation from the start. And he called himself an Orthodox reformer, meaning he wanted to make moderate reforms, he didn't want to violate traditions significantly. In 1854, he becomes the rabbi in congregation B'nai Yeshurun in Cincinnati. The goal is to create one movement of American Judaism, and he hoped that his reforms would be accepted by all American Jews, and he called his sitter Minhag America. So again, it was published in 1857. Again, you can tell by the name of the sitter, his ideology. He really wanted to achieve consensus. He wanted this to be the insight. This is the Minhag of Reform. He wanted this to be the Minhag of America. For him, unity is more important than consistency. And he established Cincinnati as the center of American Reform Judaism, right? Hebrew Union College. Now, Rabbi David Einhorn, it's a picture on the far right, born 1808, died 1879, he represented radical Reform Judaism. He is also born in Bavaria. He achieved renown in his youth as a Talmudic prodigy. He studied in the same rabbinical academy as Rabbi Rice, the most right-wing rabbi in America at that time. However, Einhorn enrolled in university, and by the time he graduated, he abandoned orthodoxy for what he calls Mosaism, which means only the moral laws and not the ceremonial laws remain. It's difficult for him to get a job as a communal rabbi because he was too controversial. in Europe. So he immigrates to the United States in 1855 to become the rabbi of Congregation Har Sinai in Baltimore. And he was different than Isaac Meir Wise because he believed that there's no value in compromising for the sake of Jewish unity. So he was more different than Rabbi Wise. He wrote his own siddur called Olat Tamid. So that was his siddur. Now, during his lifetime, he was considered far more controversial than Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, but ultimately, after his death, his ideas and his siddur ultimately won out. So basically, what you have is by the 1850s, it seems like the struggle for the soul of the Jew was going to be fought by the enlightened Orthodox and the Reformers. If you go back, 150, 160 years, yes, what was life in the 1850s? It was a battle between the modern Orthodox and the Reform movement. That's what it seemed like. It should be noted, in 1852, recently emigrated Jews from Eastern Europe established New York's first East European Orthodox synagogue, the Beth Hamedrash, which emphasized traditional study of Jewish texts, and members of the synagogue retained strong ties with East European rabbinic leaders. But it was hard to imagine, if you're living in the mid-19th century, it's hard to imagine that this group of Orthodox Jews would multiply and would eventually shape the future of traditional Judaism as it had done today. And the truth is that before the 1880s, that it seemed to fight a hopeless battle because there were no good schools, no yeshivos, few rabbis, no real authority, and no semblance of organization. But there was an attempt at unity between Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise and Rabbi Isaac Leiser. So question is, right, what's the question is, of course, there's value of unity. What's the value of unity? The value of unity is that you have harmony and interpersonal relationships. And also, if you have unity, you have standards and clarity. So the question is, how do you achieve unity in America, which favors diversity and freedom? Right? So, and there's so many different types of Jews and so many different Jewish ideologies. There were many attempts to try to create peace and unity. And it's important to understand that for centuries, Jews lived in Europe. They had lived in organized communities, kehilot of their own, and they enjoyed self-government, and unity was imposed on the community. That's the difference. In most American communities, until the middle of the 19th century, as I mentioned, you had one synagogue in every community, and the customs were determined by the majority of immigrants. And if you compare America to other countries, let's say in England. England, you had a chief rabbi. He was the central Jewish leader, and you had a board of deputies that served as the community's, to address your question, the community's officially recognized representative. In France, you had the Jewish religious leadership was vested in the central and regional committees comprised of rabbis and laymen under government mandate. And they supervised all aspects of Jewish religious life. They levied dues. They exercised monopoly power since public worship could not take place without approval of these committees. In Germany, that it was dependent on community. And everything was territorially based, and there were these communal boards that oversaw everything, and they defined the limits of normative Judaism. So based on these precedents, so you have these Jews, you know, are thinking about, like, we need to unify the people in America. They're thinking about this. They're looking at their brethren in Europe, and they're like, can we create that? Or can we create a semblance of this in the United States of America? But the truth is, every proposal fails. In 1841, Isaac Leiser sets forth the first major plan for establishing a religious union among the Jews of America. This I have here. This is the first formal attempt. He publishes this. Article 1 talks about the ecclesiastical authority. He suggests that there's going to be a delegates of the different congregations, or as many shall basically select three gentlemen of undoubted moral and religious character, who are duly learned in the written and oral law, who shall have the authority conferred upon them by their election to act and decide on all cases of religious inequity, to determine all questions laid before them according to law and their proof of rabbinic authority, etc., etc. So they're called the rabbinic authority, and so basically they're having what? What is this? A moetzes gedolei Torah. They have three rabbis who are making the ultimate decisions. Section 11: the congregations belonging to this union shall not elect any shochet who has not been examined by one or more members of this council. And the religious council will watch over the state of the religion. So in other words, he proposes that you have three rabbis who are ultimately in charge of all, you know, major issues, including, you know, if you want to have a shochet, you know, he needs to pass a test from them. And any major issues they should be in charge of. And also, he's very into schools. As soon as practicable, schools for both sexes are to be established in every town where the Israelites reside. And the teachers are to be paid out of a common local fund. And no account to receive any pay or fee, whatever, from the parents. So in other words, they believe that you basically pay to the union, and their responsibility is to pay the teachers. Whatever rates for education are to be paid by the local treasurer of this union, who is to pay the amount of salary which is to be agreed upon. And then you have the union, which is, you know, you have lay leadership to carry out this organization. So basically what he proposes is that you have a central religious council that's elected by the union. You have a network of schools, and you have a union composed of delegates from all regularly organized congregations to promote harmony and undertake concerted communal action when necessary. In other words, you have like a quote unquote like an OU, right? And then you have like a rabbinical, you have yeshivos affiliated with this lay leadership, and you also have three gedolim. That was one idea, but it never took off. It never took off. There was another idea that was proposed, and that was the appointment of a chief rabbi in order to strengthen the bonds of a traditional Jewish authority. In England, Chief Rabbi Nathan Adler, elected in 1844, was successful in achieving this goal. He gained a lot of respect, and he was successful, actually, in preventing the reform movement from spreading within the British Empire. And he achieved the dignified orthodoxy that Isaac Leiser was striving to achieve. Some people thought, who should we pick? Rabbi Abraham Rice. He was the most right-wing, but the most learned individual. In 1846, Rabbi Max Lilienthal was officially the chief rabbi of New York when he served the three German Orthodox synagogues in the city, but he resigned 3 years later, and in 1855, he moved to Cincinnati to become a rabbi and push moderate reforms. But there was no traction for a chief rabbi in America because that didn't exist with respect to other religions. There was no like chief Protestant minister. There was no archbishop with nationwide jurisdiction. So it was very easy for opponents to dismiss any Jewish effort and to say that having a chief rabbi is antithetical to American ideals. And also, in America, we believe in the separation of church and state. So we can't have any official recognition by the government. And also, Americans in general are suspicious of strong central authority. We're afraid of trampling on the rights of the minority. So we're very nervous about these things. So therefore, this failed as well. So now, something which is unheard of nowadays, obviously, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise and Rabbi Isaac Leiser get together with 15 other clergy and lay representatives in Cleveland. They have reform and modern orthodoxy meeting together to discuss, can we have something, can we create some kind of unity? Some way to unify the Jewish community. This is the first time that leading figures closest to the center of American Jewish religious spectrum actually formally met. And after hours of private deliberations, the conference adopted two guiding resolutions that I have here. Number one, you can imagine how nitpicky they are in every single word, you know? And they got out of many, many hours. We agree on two things. The Bible, as delivered to us by our fathers and as now in our possession, is of immediate divine origin and the standard of our religion. We can live with that, right? We go with that? Okay.
That's a big deal.
I understand. And the Talmud contains the traditional legal and logical exposition of the biblical laws, which must be expounded and practiced according to the comments of the Talmud. So it seems like we're pretty good with that, no? So the I understand, right? So it seems like we got sort of what we want, but at the same time, the Orthodox is criticized. Why? Rabbi Rice and even Rabbi Morris Raphael and others boycotted the meeting. They said any discussion with the proponents of reform about the religion compromised Orthodox Judaism integrity. We can't even have these kind of conversations about religion, even though it seems they got what they want. If the discussion was just on communal secular issues, so maybe that might have been different. Like, you know, board of rabbis discussed, you know, secular issues or, I don't know, anti-Semitism. But on the reform side, you can imagine Rabbi David Einhorn looks at this document. And he says, he also boycotted the meeting. And he's like, the whole notion of a conference of this type is repugnant to religious freedom and to Judaism as he understood it. And other reform rabbis said that, what is this? Like, we don't agree with this. And they're saying that we're living in America and each congregation should have the right to decide religious issues for itself. So the conference was a failure, and Wise and Lieser drew farther apart. Judaism polarized into Orthodox and Reform camps. And what the conference underscored was essentially the deepening of ideological division. There was an attempt, but obviously this highlighted the fact that, you know, we're not going to be able to come together. But Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise had not given up on unity. He just says, okay, I can't do it with Rabbi Isaac Lieser, but I'm going to try to get basically all of America to buy into my brand of Judaism. So in the 1860s and 1870s, the Jews grew in wealth, in power. There was a feeling of universalism in the air. The seating capacity of synagogues doubled during the 1860s and 1870s. New temples and new synagogues are being built. The number of synagogues with organs leaped from 8 to 30 between 1860 and 1868. Many synagogues also had mixed seating. And the American mantra was that the family that prays together stays together. Of course, their kids probably likely will intermarry, but okay, they didn't say that. But by the end of the 19th century, seating is what divides the Orthodox and the Reform synagogues for the most part. And basically, the Reform movement, they're all getting rid of Second Yom Tov. Many synagogues also adopt shorter, non-Orthodox liturgies, like Rabbi Weiss's Minhag America, and there's organ music, vernacular readings, and some congregations discarded the requirement of talitot and kippot. And the new Reform way had four goals in mind: attract younger Americanized Jews to the synagogue, make non-Jewish friends and visitors feel welcome, improve Judaism's public image, and create that kind of solemn, formal, awe-inspiring atmospheres that Jews and Christians felt were necessary for effective devotional prayer. And in fact, it looked like the Reform would win in the 1870s. Prominent synagogues like Temple Israel in Boston and Rodef Shalom in Philadelphia joined the Reform movement. Rabbi Isaac Lieser had died, and there was no, quote-unquote, modern Orthodox leader to be able to turn the tide. Reform thought it won, and therefore Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise established his dream in 1873, the establishment of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. Notice what word is not in there. It says the American Union of American Hebrew Congregations. What? Well, no, Hebrew is Judaism. It doesn't say Reform. It doesn't say Reform. Because this is not about Reform. He basically thinks the Reform has won, and this is now, we're going to create a union of synagogues. He sees more and more Orthodox synagogues become Reform, and now we're going to make a union of synagogues. The goal, his goal, was he wanted Orthodox synagogues also to join, not just Reform synagogues. And this was lay-driven. The feeling was that if it's less divisive, it's been run by laity than clergy. And the goals of the new organization was to establish a rabbinical seminary, to publish books appropriate for Jewish religious schools, and to propose at least a small number of Jewish rituals that all Jews might consent to be bound by. The latter goal was quickly abandoned. No rituals. The organization focused on preserving Jewish identity and the importance of promoting Jewish education by training English-speaking rabbis and teachers. No more German-speaking rabbis. And this union then establishes Hebrew Union College in 1875. So now they have a lay organization, they have a seminary, and Rabbi Wise was the president. Again, the goal was union, Hebrew Union College, okay? And the nine young pupils focused on classical texts. They didn't speak a lot about Mashiach and doctrinal issues. Because his goal, he wanted to try to attract everyone. Everyone come to my set seminary. There's no other seminary at that point. And he believed that a self-confident, appropriately moderate, and communally responsible Reform Judaism representing the majority of Jews could represent leadership for the entire American Jewish community. He believed that unity was in reach. However, there was a series of unanticipated crises that ended his dreams. First, the Reform Judaism was shaken by the defection of Felix Adler. He was the son of the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in New York. He had been sent to Germany to follow in his father's footsteps. In 1876, he publicly abandons Judaism in favor of what he called ethical culture. He advocates a universalistic faith focused on ethics and teachings of world religions. Now, how could that be? If Reform Judaism solved everything, the son of the rabbi went off to Derech. Number two, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise's daughter, among other prominent Jews, intermarried. And now many Jews are nervous. Is the strategy of Reform Judaism, again, it's not just, again, sometimes people intermarry, but again, this is like the daughter of the Gadol Hador. Again, it happens, you know, but this is like the daughter, like, see, again, you have the son of the rabbi, the most prominent synagogue, or one of the most prominent synagogues, Reform synagogues, and the daughter of the Gadol of the Reform movement, right, she intermarries. And is Reform the answer to preserve Judaism? And also, many Christians start pushing for a Christian America. There was this feeling initially of universalistic brotherhood, but then you had a lot of preaching, a lot of missionizing, and many Jews came to believe that Christians were hoping that Jews would eventually see the light. And there was also a lot of anti-Semitism that unnerved many Jews. There was a rise of hatred in Germany that shocked the Jews, and it spread to America. There was a judge, Henry Hilton, that he excluded the wealthy Jewish banker Joseph Seligman from the Grand Union Hotel in 1877, and wealthy entrepreneur Austin Corbin's public announcement that Jews as a class would be unwelcome in Coney Island, and anti-Semitism challenged the assumption that reforming religion would eventually lead to greater acceptance. So that shook them. So they were nervous religiously of whether Reform was really enough to keep Jews engaged. And they thought that Reform also would help stem the tide of anti-Semitism, and they were also nervous about that. Pogroms broke out in 1881 in Russia, sending millions of Jews to America over the next 45 years, which radically changed the landscape of Judaism in this country. I forgot to show you. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that you had here his constitution I brought here, that this is Wise's Constitution, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, 1873, and his object, his goal there. In any case, let me finish with the final break between Orthodox and Reform. The final break was known as, I'm sure familiar with this, the famous Treif dinner. On July 11th, 1883, at the Smicha, you know, the celebration, the ordination of Hebrew Union College's initial class of four rabbis. It was celebrated in Cincinnati. And it was also the 10th anniversary of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. More than 100 rabbinic and lay leaders at representing more than 75 congregations throughout the country gathered for this wonderful celebration highlighting the unity of the Jewish community in America. However, if you see on the menu, it's hard to see. If you can see, some of the things are off on the menu. You got a little shellfish going on here. You got some crabs, clams. You got basar b'chalav. So there's also frog's legs. I can't read where it says frog's legs in here, but apparently there were also frog's legs. So there was a lot of, like, really, again, there's no pork. So no, I'm not doing that, like, I'm not trying to be cynical about it, but I'm saying they probably would not have pork. Yeah.
So is it thought that this was merely tone deaf, or was it a deliberate statement?
So it's not so clear. It's not so clear. I think that, it seems, that this was done out of carelessness and not, they're just not mocking. In other words, it doesn't seem like it was, oh, we're going to show we're anti-Orthodox. It would seem, you know, as the caterer, like they hired a caterer. And he's like, oh, what is traditional Judaism? What are we against? We're against pork. So there's no pork on the menu. But it seems it was done out of carelessness and not malice. Some of the guests, again, there's a guest for this reform celebration. They were horrified. They walked out in anger. Now, instead of apologizing for this mistake, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, the man who wanted consensus and tried to build unity, so at this point he took offense against what he called kitsch, because this is his dream of bringing all these people together, and he took offense as to what he called kitchen Judaism, and he insisted that the dietary laws had lost their validity. And as a result of this banquet, calls rang out for the establishment of a new and more traditional rabbinical seminary. Again, you already had the Orthodox are not joining, but you had the Reform, and people felt the Reform had gone too far. In May of 1885, okay, the Hungarian Alexander Kohut, I'm not sure if I pronounced his name correctly, one of Europe's leading Jewish scholars, arrives in America. And he occupies middle ground between Orthodox and Reform, and he follows the more conservative traditions of the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau. He champions a more conservative rather than radical reform of Judaism. He held that progress can only be effected within the limits of revealed law, and he says that reform, which seeks to progress without the rabbinic tradition, is a deformity. It's a skeleton without flesh. It's and sinews without spirit and heart. It is suicide and not reform. The son-in-law of Rabbi David Einhorn, Kaufman Kohler, responded to Kohut, and this controversy became as the Kohut-Kohler controversy, and it helped clarify the differences between two long-standing strategies for securing Judaism's future. And this occurred only a few short years after the Reform had thought that their brand of Judaism would become accepted in America. In response to this controversy, Kohler organized a conference just outside of Pittsburgh from November 16th to November 18th. 1885, where 18 rabbis, including Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, joined Kohler in an attempt to formulate a platform for Reform Judaism, what it stands for. There's no longer are we going to let's just skirt over the differences and let's all try to get everyone together. So then what happened was we want to create a platform. What does Reform Judaism stand for? This is the Pittsburgh Platform of 1885. And the goal was to be liberal and enlightened, but also firm enough not to be agnostic. In other words, we don't belong to Felix Adler's ethical culture movement. We don't want to continue the historical thread of the past. So it's an 8-point platform, which was speedily adopted by the conference. It's called the Pittsburgh Platform. So you see, the first one is the last sentence of the first paragraph. We maintain Judaism and preserve, defended, midst continual struggles, this God idea is the central religious truth for the human race. So they buy into the history of the Jewish people, and we brought them into the world. And they also, in this paragraph 2, they recognize in the Bible, you know, the holiness of the Jewish people to its mission of one God. And And they said, but modern scientific discoveries are not antagonistic to doctrines of Judaism. Okay. Number three, they say that we recognize that the Mosaic legislation training Jewish people for its mission during its national life in Palestine, that there was a part, some of the laws were good for Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. Today, what do we accept? Only its moral laws. Okay? But not, oh, we accept the moral laws in paragraph three, but paragraph four, any laws that regulate diet, priestly purity, and dress, that is foreign to modern, the zeitgeist of the time. They fail to impress the modern Jew, and therefore we don't need to engage in dietary laws. They believe, number paragraph five, we recognize the approaching of the realization of Israel's great messianic hope for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice and peace among all men. That's what Howie was mentioning before, that we believe we're living the messianic now in America. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community. We don't plan on going back to Eretz Yisrael. We don't plan on korbanos. And we recognize, number six, we recognize Judaism is a progressive religion. Okay, we want to cooperate with other religions. And paragraph seven, we reassert the doctrine of Judaism that the soul is immortal. Fine. But we reject, as ideas not rooted in Judaism, the beliefs, and we reject bodily resurrection and Gehenna and Gan Eden. So they reject Chias HaMesim and Gan Eden and Gehenna. And so essentially, this platform marks the final break between Orthodoxy and Reform in 1885. Conservatives use this platform to further their aim of establishing in New York a competing seminary to Hebrew Union College, which became known as the Jewish Theological Seminary. So just to summarize where we got to today, there's often a tension between the desire for unity to create standards, to create strength in numbers, and or for the sake of shalom, versus a desire to promote one's own positions. There's also a tension between the need to have standards for institutions with the reality that if someone doesn't like the standards, then he or she may simply leave. And then there's the challenge of freedom and choice when it comes to religious observance. In Europe, everyone was forced to belong to a singular synagogue community, often with a singular rabbinical figure. America is the land of the free, and there is freedom to exercise my religion as I choose, and the state will not get involved in religious disputes. Therefore, the Jewish community transformed itself from being a synagogue community to a community of synagogues, each one trying to attract the modern American Jew. Attempts, though, to create standards and unity and strength in numbers. There were attempts, right, to create unity. First by Rabbi Isaac Leiser, then by a union of moderate Orthodox and Reformers, before there was an understanding, as there is now, of the enormous gap between these two movements. And then, when Rabbi Isaac Meirweiss thinks that he has won by the Reform. However, by the 1880s, when the Reform movement thought that it had won, it came to realize that that was not the case because it had gone too far for some, opening the door for conservative Judaism, and it may not have seemed to be the answer to solve the Jewish problem in America with the growing anti-Semitism and the defection of the Reform movement's leaders or family members of the Reform movement leaders to abandon the Reform movement or Judaism altogether. Additionally, pogroms break out in 1881 in Russia, sending millions of Jews to America over the next 45 years, which radically changes the landscape of Judaism in this country. And the Orthodox, where are the Orthodox here? The Orthodox was not giving up, and they built schools and yeshivos and eventually rabbinic seminaries at this time. But at this point, no longer were the Orthodox consider a unified laity and rabbinic leadership of the Reform movement. But the question remained, though, in the 1880s, when you start having this Jewish theological seminary and this group of Jews who feel that Reform has moved too far and they want to push back more tradition. So how should Orthodox Jews feel about the new conservative movement? Those Jews who walked out of that Treifa banquet in 1883 and who thought that the reforms advocated by the reform movement went too far, could there be any hope of unity between the new conservative Jews and the Orthodox movement in America? And this is what we're going to discuss in our next session.